So let's just open the floor for some initial discussion of the class and gender problem, as we've discussed it so far, or any other issues that came out of your reading. And then at about, let's say in about 15 minutes, I'll turn to this knotty question of the effects of class and gender around this distinction between functional and interest explanations. Yeah, Maddie.
So in the Goldthorpe, you know, it's pretty clear that he doesn't want to count the woman's job. But and then you talk about various family situations in class counts. But I was wondering, what about the family situation with the male is a small business owner and the wife either does sort of unpaid work within the business or takes a public sector job in order to provide health benefits and stuff that enable the business to run, but don't have a direct and very easy to measure.
Well, first of all, that effect is probably not so hard to measure. That is, if you have a family in which the wife is in a public sector job with benefits that the husband shares in, and that it provides a steady stream of income and the small business has ups and downs, you'd be able to ask the question, how are the interests of the members of this household shaped by these two different connections to the class structure? And in that case, one would say that the mediated class position of the husband, that is for that person, is very important. And his interests in the security of his wife's job would be very high. one might even... There certainly could be circumstances in which one would say that the woman's class position matters more for the fate of the family, for the interests and well-being of the family, than does the husband's class position in such a situation. So from my perspective on this, class heterogeneity of households, it's really important to understand that this affects everybody in the household. It's not just that I'm saying that women's class position are affected by her husband's class job. Rather, the husbands are also affected by the woman's job class, and the children's class position are affected by both. And what the weight is, what the weight of each is, really depends very heavily upon how the fate of the family, how vulnerable or how secure is the fate of the family with respect to these different poles from the different ways in which the family as a unit is connected to the class structure. and that may be hard to tell. It may be that sometimes it gets ambiguous, not just complex, because you can't really tell. Particularly, you can't tell if there's vulnerability that isn't, because people may not be aware of the vulnerability connected to each of these positions. Does that help?
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah.
It's kind of an add-on to that. I've actually never thought about that. If one of the spouses takes the job primarily for benefits, health insurance, for instance, versus primarily for income, how would that really affect class?
Well, benefits are just a form of income. That is...
It won't really change their material interests.
Yeah.
It just affect their lived experience, though.
No. If you have health insurance, medical expenses are part of the cost of living. It's part of you have material interests in having health care. The well-being of your body is one of your material interests. And if you don't have health insurance, then you either have to pay out of pocket or you don't get access to that commodity, to that service. And so I think benefits are benefits are just a specialized form of income. It's an income in kind, you know, for a particular access to a particular service, but it still should be thought of as basic, as a basic part of your, just like pensions are. Pensions are just deferred income. If you're in a job that has a good pension, that means that part of the costs of reproducing your labor power are being deferred until after you retire, so that your labor, you know, your person can be reproduced at a given standard of living beyond that. But it should be just thought of as a complex component of income and thus of material interests. Yeah.
Mostly your discussion and critique of Goldthorpe's piece in Class Counts, and I was just kind of curious how you would contrast the way that you critique, especially Goldthorpe's understanding of class interests, with, say, like, how would someone who was approaching this piece from a Weberian lens, would they also be troubled by the sort of Goldthorpe's very narrow conception of class interests, or does a Marxist approach and Weberian approach?
I don't think the issue in play here is really Marx versus Weber. Indeed, okay. Goldthorpe is often thought of as a kind of neo-Weberian because he focuses a lot on market relations. Mm-hmm. Although he also has he has a very interesting and I think rich concept of employment relation as an aspect of class relations, which gets very close to my way of talking about it as well. I'm talking about the relations inside of production. He calls them employment relations. It's not all that different. There's some difference, but not a big difference. So the the main difference, I think, has to do with how refined a notion of material interests one has, and how one sees those as connected to one's position in the class structure. And I think Goldthorpe just doesn't think it through very carefully in that respect. I don't think it's intrinsic in his account of class. I think it's just a failure of him to understand that interests can be contradictory and complex rather than simple. So I would say, you know, in the traditional household in developed capitalist countries, if one had to say the class of all members of the household are the same and they have to be identified with one and only one person, then your best bet would be to say, okay, the male breadwinner is probably your best bet, right? You'll get the best first approximation by identifying it with that one single person's position in the class structure. Why? Because that one single person is likely to define the interests of the other members of the household with respect to the acquisition of income and the strategies needed to improve their life. But the big question is, why restrict yourself in that way? Why insist on that simplicity? Goldthorpe's basic argument is that when push comes to shove, in most households, if the career advantages of the husband come into conflict with the career advantages of the wife, and a choice has to be made, for example, do we move to another city where we get a big promotion for the husband, or stay where we are and don't because of the wife's job? Well, in most circumstances, he argues, the husband's interests, job-based interests, will triumph in that kind of conflict. But the reason for that is just that the income stream generated by the husband's career advances will be much bigger than the income stream generated by the wife's. In those cases where that isn't true, and increasingly there are cases where it isn't true, then that wouldn't be the case. And even when it is true, it doesn't follow that just because in that sharp situation where you have to make a choice, there is no middle ground, that in many other situations the interest of the family is a combination of the interests that are brought into the household by virtue of the separate classes. And one other final comment here. The consequences of being in a class for a person. So get back to basics. So the reason we care about this is because we believe that how a person is located in a class structure matters a lot for their lives. But only one of the ways it matters is interests. It also matters because of what I've referred to as lived experience. So some things happen to you by virtue of your class position that are not just a question of what your income stream is. You get humiliated at work, right? So the experience of humiliation at work, of being disparaged by a boss, that's an experience. It shapes your identities, your sense of self, and it's something that happens by virtue of being in a particular class position in a particular workplace. Now that aspect of your class location is much more limited to your direct class. Now, if your spouse is humiliated at work and you aren't, you will feel empathy. It'll have some spillover effects, but mostly those effects come from your direct class location. So one way of thinking about this is that some aspects of class depend upon your own position inside of the class structure, and some of the effects of your connection to the class structure don't depend on that. It depends upon your family's connection to the class structure, not just yours. And these may operate in different ways.
The question I addressed in this convention report, the question is the following. How do cooperative owners fit in the schema? Class schema presented in the classes on page 50 and the table. So as far as they share the profit, the owners, actually there is no exploitation. So I see this is not simple commodity production, neither simple commodity nor capitalist mode of production. So I would kind of suggest, imply that this is maybe a distinct kind of cooperative, maybe socialist mode of production. But they have kind of a general structure, so some elected managers, and there are employees. So maybe there is some kind of domination. So there is kind of cooperative employees and cooperative managers, two classes, in this distinct mode of production.
So worker-owned firms, worker cooperatives, are a particular kind of way of organizing production. And in a capitalist society, worker cooperatives are usually what I would call a hybrid form of production. That is, they combine within themselves different kinds of relations of production. In a pure worker cooperative, all workers in a firm are owners. And the only exception would be future members who are on probation. So a typical cooperative, if it wants to recruit new worker owners, there'll be a probationary period to see if the person works out or not. And so in that probationary period, that's true, they are employees. But they're a very special kind of employee, and I don't think it's proper to describe them as capitalist employees. It's really a different social relationship. You know, they're kind of a proto-owners, even if they're not actual owners. But many worker cooperatives, actually, in addition to that, will have some employees. Because it's often the case that, for example, Isthmus Engineering in Madison, it's very successful, extremely interesting worker cooperative, produces robots and other high-end, advanced manufacturing machines is what they manufacture. And they have a certain number of employees who are not proto members. All of those employees have the option of becoming worker owners, but some just want a job. You know, some of them say, I don't want to invest part of my wage. In order to become a worker owner, you have to take 10% of your wages or something over a period of time to create a capital fund, so you get a capital stake in the firm. And they say, I don't want that. I just want to do my job and go home at night. So they choose to be workers. Well, that still makes them different from an ordinary capitalist worker, because workers in a capitalist firm aren't given the choice. Do you want to be a full equal owner or stay permanently a worker? It's up to you. What do you want? So this becomes You know, this is more like capitalism between consenting adults. I mean, the non-member workers in that firm are fully able to choose something else, and they just, for whatever reasons, decide not to. Again, that makes it a kind of complicated relation. But I think for the topic at hand in terms of gender, this is kind of off the topic of class and gender. This is just about the nature of, yeah. Other thoughts on the things we've talked about so far? Okay, I'll venture into the murky waters of functional and interest explanations. So both of these are attempts at getting at a set of issues, a set of kind of explanations where we want to say something of the form, why are gender relations the way they are, or why are race relations the way they are? And one answer to the question is because of some process in the class structure which explains those aspects of either gender or race. Okay, so these are two ways in which class can help explain aspects of gender. To understand this, I need to briefly explain what a functional explanation is. The simplest kind of functional explanations occur in biology. And this is where it's completely standard. If you want to answer the question, why are the bones in the wings of birds hollow? How do we explain why the bones in the wings of birds are hollow? A good answer is that hollow bones are lighter, and this is what enables birds to fly. That the wings of birds would be too heavy to flap if the bones were solid. So the light bones are what is explained by their function in enabling birds to fly. Why is the neck of the giraffe so long? That's one of the favorite examples. Because it enables the giraffe to eat the leaves of the acacia tree, you know, at the top. In each case, the explanation for some property of a creature, the explanation is in terms of its beneficial effects on the creature. So whenever you explain something by its beneficial consequences, you're invoking a functional explanation. You explain a property of a body by virtue of its benefits for the organism. And that's explaining something by its effects. And that seems a little ass backwards, right? You explain things by its causes, not by its effects. That's why functional explanations are kind of weird. Well, the reason why you can get away with it in biology is because of our theory of evolution. Evolutionary biology provides us with a very nice and fantastically powerful explanation for how it comes to pass that things which are beneficial for organisms come to be, namely natural selection. But it still is a functional explanation because it explains why natural selection selects things the way it does. It selects properties of creatures that contribute to its reproductive fitness. Well, you know that kind of story. A big issue in the social sciences is whether functional explanations have any place in social science. They clearly have a place in biological science. We normally no longer believe in functional explanations in astronomy. So it was in medieval times people would say, why is the sun warm? And the answer is in order to provide us with heat, you know, because of its benefits for humanity. In the medieval understanding of the functional explanation for the warmth of the sun, there was a causal explanation behind it. How did this come to pass? Well, God designed it that way. That's why intelligent design is one way of elaborating functional relations in biology without invoking evolution. Well, people used to have intelligent design for the cosmos because they felt that the sun was obviously so important for us, for providing us with warmth. There must be a reason for it. Well, we know now there is no reason for the sun to provide warmth on the earth. It just does. And then evolutionary biology explains why, given these very special parameters, creatures evolved to the point where they could worry about why the sun is warm. Okay, functional explanations are to be contrasted with another kind of explanation which has a superficial affinity. They look the same sometimes with soft focus, but they're quite different. And these are called interest explanations. And they sometimes get confused, these two kinds of explanations. In an interest explanation, an explanation involves the intentions of persons. For example, why are tax policies beneficial to rich people? Because politicians intentionally design tax policies in the expectation that they will serve the interests of rich people. That's why the tax policies are the way they are, because it was the purpose of the designers of the tax policies. They wanted to serve the interests of their patrons. They figured out the best taxes policy to do so, and that's the explanation. This is explaining things by the intentions of people, which serve particular interests. Now, here again, there are beneficial effects of something that explains it, right? The policy is beneficial for the rich. That helps to explain it. But they do so because of the conscious design of the policies, rather than by some process that operates behind the backs of actors. And in the design, in interest explanations, it's always the anticipated effects of the policy which explains why it is the way it is. Not the actual effects, it's the anticipated effects. Whereas in functional explanations, it's the actual effects of the hollow bones that explains why they are the way they are. Because there are no anticipated effects. The key, so if you just look at the policy and you see it benefiting people, you can't distinguish these two. You can't distinguish because the policies actually do benefit people. But the actual explanation for why they are the way they are is not because they actually benefit people. That's how it turned out. They are the way they are because politicians thought in advance that they would benefit people. Yeah.
So it sounds like one of the major differences between the two is that for interest explanations, someone's kind of behind the scenes pulling the strings.
Right.
Whereas in functional explanations, it just kind of is because of only because of the benefits. Is that
right? The actual benefits are explaining it. Okay. Now, as we will see, we're going to revisit this theme many times. As we'll see, there are circumstances where the two explanations fit nicely together. That is, an example would be a policy is created because of its anticipated effects, behind the scenes manipulating it. The policy is put in place. It generates different effects from the ones anticipated. And that triggers a change in the policy. So that although each trigger involves anticipations, the triggering is by the actual effects, and then eventually the policy settles down to the right policy. Well, that's kind of a combination of both types of explanation. Interests are doing a lot of work, but so are the actual effects of the policy doing work. And because there's this interweaving of actual effects and anticipated effects, I think one can reasonably describe that as a combined intentional and functional explanation, or interest and functional explanation. Yeah.
So dealing with the idea of intelligent design then, because you said that, like, you know, when you're explaining functional explanation, that things were that way because God wanted them that way, but wouldn't that be interest explanation?
Right, so, right, so the, it gets, of course, you're invoking God as an intentional character who is designing the world. And because of the combination of omniscience and omnipotence, there is no distinction between anticipated consequences and actual consequences, because God always knows what the actual consequences will be. You know, so it collapses the two, basically, in effect. Okay, so let's get back to gender and just see how this works. A functional explanation and interest explanations often work together, but they do have some different features. So here's a class functional explanation of male domination. A class functional. Why is male domination the way it is? Because it serves certain functions for class. Aspects of male domination in contemporary society are explained by virtue of their positive effects for capitalists or capitalism. An example of this would be in the Marxist-feminist discussion of unpaid labor in the household. One of the forms of this explanation was, why do women perform unpaid labor in the household? Because this lowers the costs of reproducing labor power, and it's good for capital accumulation. That would be a functional explanation. The division of labor in the household serves, has benefits for capitalism, and that explains why it is the way it is. A class interests explanation would have the form, aspects of male domination in contemporary society are explained because capitalists realize that male domination is in their interests and see to it that male domination continues. That policymakers see that these relationships are beneficial for capitalism, and they institute them as a result. Similar kinds of arguments are often encountered for racism. We'll see that on Thursday. For nationalism and many other things. In contemporary Marxism, there are plenty of examples of functional explanations that bear on gender issues. Friedrich Engels' famous book, The Origins of the Family, Private Property, and the State. It's a complex, extremely interesting argument about the origins of male domination. It's based on what is now generally thought of as very shaky anthropological evidence. And the interest in the book is more, I think, in the reasoning it contains than in its historical or empirical accuracy. But it's a good example of an attempt to mobilize actual evidence from what was then considered reliable anthropological evidence, data and historical data on pre-modern societies in order to build an argument. And his basic argument is this, that a gender division of labor pre-existed male domination, so that in pre-modern hunting and gathering societies, there was a gender division of labor that had biological foundations, given the level of technology, in which women had greater responsibility for early child rearing and domestic tasks, and men for hunting and large animal husbandry. That division of labor did not involve domination, in Engels' view. It was just a division of labor that was practical given biological constraints, particularly around nursing and early child rearing, that you would not take babies with you on hunting woolly mammoths, so to speak. In this division of labor, men tended to have control over the most valuable potential heritable property, large animals being the critical property. For men to ensure that this property would be inherited by their own progeny, they needed to control access of other men to the fertility of the mothers of their children. So that's the key problem to be solved, that you always know the maternity of babies, but you don't know the paternity of babies unless you can guard the fertility of the, you know, of sexual reproduction of the mothers. Male domination of women is the mechanism through which this control of reproduction is assured, but this only becomes functionally required once there is heritable property. That is, before, as long as you are hunters and gatherers without heritable property, then men didn't have to dominate women in order to ensure their continuity. Male domination is explained by the functional requirements for stable systems of an inheritance once you have private property. Prior to private property, there was no need to have male control, no functional requirement for men to control the fertility of women. In contemporary feminism, a functional argument is around the unpaid housework. The argument is basically the provision of unpaid domestic labor is beneficial for capitalists by lowering the cost of reproducing labor. The question becomes, who will perform this unpaid labor? So the functional argument is unpaid labor will be beneficial to capitalists because they don't have to pay for it, lowers the cost of reproducing labor power. There are three options. The unpaid labor could be equally shared. It could be predominantly performed by women, or it could be predominantly performed by men. The argument then unfolds that until recent times, the care of small children was most easily and efficiently done by women because of breastfeeding and because of relatively high fertility needed to ensure surviving adult children. So that's, again, invoking a biological fact, given existing levels of technology. And because of this, it was more efficient for households, for mothers and wives to take primary responsibility for the unpaid household tasks. The allocation of the men to the role of full-time breadwinner and the wife to homemaker will be more efficient than other arrangements from the point of view of working class households, not just from the point of view of capitalists. This is the cheapest solution for capitalists and the most advantageous for households. And that combination of it being the cheapest solution for a house for capitalists and the most advantageous for households means that this solution will be the most stable in capitalism. Allocating women to these roles generates their subordination to men because of economic dependency, isolation, and lowered status. But underwriting the whole process is this functionality, that it's beneficial for capitalism to have this unpaid labor. That's the kind of functional argument that goes along with it. Well, both of these functional arguments have been heavily criticized. I mean, I think you can think of problems with both of them. But that's one way in which Marxist accounts of how class affects gender. It affects gender by functionally subordinating gender relations to the requirements of either private property, in Engels' case, or the maximizing the rate of accumulation in the contemporary Marxist feminist case. A second sort of way that effects of class on gender have been elaborated is not so much to ask and to examine the question, what's functional for capitalism? You know, is male domination functional for capitalism? But rather to examine the way in which capitalism can obstruct transformations, even if a relationship is not particularly functional. And here the argument is basically that class structures shape the resources available for struggle, because class structures are above all about how resources are controlled. And since struggles over non-class oppression requires the mobilization of resources, class structures can impinge on the possibilities of transformation, even if the relations aren't serving any particular function. So an example for this would be even if there's no particularly good function served for capitalism with having women be engaged in primary childcare, to transform the gender relations around childcare would require the allocation of new resources for public childcare facilities. And the struggles to control the resources necessary to provide for good quality publicly provided childcare, those struggles would be against the interests of capital because of the implications for taxes and other public programs. And so the resistance to the transformation of gender relations comes not because the existing relations themselves are positively functional, but because the costs of transforming those relations would have negative effects on the interests of powerful actors. So that's a different kind of argument for how class would shape gender. Class structures shape gender relations because they obstruct the necessary kind of transformations required to fundamentally change those gender relations. Finally, in terms of the effects of class on gender, there's the question of whether there's a dynamic asymmetry between class and gender. Now, this is an argument which I used to feel more confident about than I do at the moment, but you know, I don't think it's quite as strong an argument, as compelling an argument as I once did. That's because I have more doubts about the specific claims of the dynamics on the class side than I do around the gender side. Let me just lay out the argument and explain what this is about. So here the question is looking at the reciprocal effects of class and gender dynamically rather than just structurally. And if we want to ask the question, is it changes in class structure or changes in gender, which has the bigger effect on the other? Do changes in class structure have a bigger impact on gender relations, or changes in gender relations have an impact on class structure? So let's first look at gender in these terms. Why have gender relations become so dramatically changed in the past half century compared to the previous 50 years? How do we explain this? There's been a massive entry of women into the labor force, which is a change in their class locations. This seems to be a critical factor. The dynamics of capitalism, changes in the demand for different kinds of labor, is what really drives this entry of women into the labor force. And this triggers and produces transformations in gender relations. The question is, can we imagine a symmetrical, reciprocal argument about the effects of gender on class? So we have a notion of there being laws of motion of capitalism. Capitalism develops and pushes the society in particular directions, and that the development of the forces of production and the development of capitalism in the period accelerating in the 1950s is substantially the explanation for why the conditions of labor forces were transformed in such dramatic ways that women enter the labor force in the way they did. Is there an equivalent laws of motion of gender dynamics? Well, my previous view was that that it's hard to imagine there being some internal laws of motion of gender. There are gender conflicts, but they don't have any intrinsic driving directionality to them. Whereas there is an argument for why there's directionality to the development of the forces of production. Once forces move in a particular direction, they are sticky downward. They're less likely to reverse. So the development of technology and capitalism, which is the underlying dynamic that makes capitalism change its form over time, does seem to have a directionality. However, and this is where I have more hesitation about this dynamic asymmetry argument, there's no intrinsic reason why that should be disruptive to gender relations. It just happens to have been. But there isn't anything in the nature of technological change which of necessity means that gender relations will be disrupted. It turns out that it did. And so we can explain these particular developments by changes that occurred in the economic structure in the last 50 years. But it isn't the case that that's inherent in the logic of the development of the forces of production, that it be disruptive to gender. And that's the reason why I think it's contingently the case that changes in the economic structure produce these changes in gender that we've actually observed, but not intrinsically the case. Yeah, Joe.
I feel like this argument is completely forgetting about the women's movement and its role in changing gender.
Right, but the question is why there's been a women's movement for 150 years.
Right.
Why was it successful in the 50s and 60s and accelerated in the 70s and 80s, but not in the 1920s, the 1880s? Similarly for the civil rights movement, why does it get its breakthroughs in the 60s, but not in the 1920s? And the argument there is the conditions of possibility for its success depend upon changing structural conditions. And those changing structural conditions were propelled by changes in the class dynamics of capitalism. And I think that's a pretty good argument, you know, that the women's movement is absolutely essential. Struggles are necessary for transformation. Without the civil rights movement, you wouldn't have gotten rid of Jim Crow. But you wouldn't have gotten rid of, the civil rights movement couldn't have produced a destruction of the southern racial state in the absence of changes in the basic economic structure which made that possible. And then that's an argument we'll look at on Thursday. So I think that's how to think about the relationship between the structural conditions and struggles. Struggles are absolutely essential, but whether or not they're successful is not just up to the will of the people engaged in struggle.
I guess to me it almost sounds a little bit technically determinist to say that the civil rights movement couldn't have happened like 10 years earlier, 20 years earlier, or you know, just because the forces of production didn't develop to a certain extent that allowed for the potential.
So it turns out it's not so much the forces of production per se, it was the destruction of sharecropping. So if southern agriculture had remained the way it was in 1910, the civil rights movement would not have succeeded in the South. The destruction of sharecropping occurred because of a combination of technological change and the state policies of the New Deal, turns out to have actually destroyed sharecropping. But you still needed that change in the underlying class structure of racial domination in the South in order for the racial order to have been disrupted. And you know, struggles in the South in the 1910s could not win. They could in the 1950s. I mean, there's more going on. This is a kind of stripped down account. And I think that's pretty true for gender relations as well. What happens in the course of the 50s and 60s and then really accelerating afterwards is that the system of male domination that reproduced the subordination of women begins to crumble because there are increasing interests, powerful interests, and needs in the economy which are contradicted by male domination. I mean, male domination, keeping women in the home, it would have very adverse effects to the rhythms of capitalist development in the United States starting and accelerating from the 60s on. There would have been huge shortages of labor power in the absence of tapping into this gigantic source of unused labor, namely women, educated women in the home. And that's the shift in the configuration of interests and power, which then opens the space for the women's movement to attack the institutionalized forms of male domination and the legal forms that backed it. Okay. Let's move on just briefly to this last really interesting theme on visions of emancipation and the nature of Marxism and feminism as theoretical structures. So let me make some comments on the emancipatory, I'll jump to number two, the emancipatory visions here. This is a pretty interesting problem, I think, to think about. What's the emancipatory vision in feminism in contrast to Marxism? Marxism is pretty clear. I think, you know, the code words are clear at any rate. Exactly what it means in terms of institutions isn't always clear. But the ideal is a classless society. And the aphorism that's used to describe what is a classless society, it's a society in which people governed by the principle to each according to need, from each according to ability. a world in which that was true, where everybody got what they needed and everybody contributed what they were able, would be a world without classes. You know, that's a kind of, again, bumper sticker description of what it would mean to not have a class structure, to each according to need, from each according to ability. It's the way well-functioning, vibrant families organize their internal distribution. Everybody gets what they need and everybody contributes what they can. It's the way friends on a camping trip, you know, organize their division of labor, right? To each according to need, from each according to ability. So it's pretty clear that what that means. One would not describe that world as a world of class equality. Indeed, the very notion of class equality seems like a meaningless idea. If it's equal, in that deep sense, it wouldn't be classes anymore. But what about gender? What's the normative vision? Is it gender equality or is it genderlessness? Is there a symmetry between the class vision and the gender vision? So in the class context, we don't want simple equality between classes. We want to get rid of classes. In the gender case, it's not so obvious. And that's because the term gender is doing double duty in the argument. It's serving, it has two kinds of meanings or functions within the theory. On the one hand, it's a description of a socially constructed set of roles that structure the interactions between men and women in various sites of social interaction. So to describe the interactions between men and women as not just the interactions between persons, which they are, of course, as well, but the interactions that are based on gender, to describe it that way is to say there are particular aspects of the interactions of men and women that are systematic, of their interactions, that are systematically structured by virtue of them being men and women, as opposed to just being persons. That's what it means to describe the interactions as gendered, as opposed to just personed, as it were, or social. And the question then is the ideal of gender emancipation one in which gender ceases to structure the interactions between persons, and therefore you have degendered relations or genderless relations? Or is it that you have fully constituted gender relations, but the interactions are just on an egalitarian basis, with no differences in power, status, or opportunity? And there's different views on this matter. You know, this is a debate within feminism, whether genderlessness or gender equality. I think there's part of the confusion in this discussion occurs because of a lack of care in the idea that gender is a socially constructed category. Right? So biological sex is the raw material, which then gets transformed through a set of social constructions into gender relations. Horses don't have genders, right? So when that filly in the Kentucky Derby won a couple of years ago, a female horse won. There was commentators were interviewing lots of women about whether they felt solidarity with this female horse. And there were women, you know, it's understandable, cultural symbols matter a lot. People were excited that it was a filly that won against the boys. It was all this kind of symbolic rhetoric that was going on. And there were some, and on one end, NPR station, that one of the interviewers asked a woman whether the fact that it was a horse of her gender. Now, horses don't have gender. They have sexes, but they don't have genders. You know, they don't have genders because there's no socially constructed role they don't construct roles. I mean, now there's a kind of imputed gender from human beings because they anthropomorphize their pets and their animals. But so if we take seriously the distinction between sex and gender, the gender is the socially constructed role, socially constructed character, and sex is much less socially constructed. There's some, you know, there's issues there as well, because sexuality and sexes aren't as simple binaries as people sometimes think. So I'm not saying there's no social construction around sex per se, but gender is specifically a socially constructed. So what it means to have the socially constructed categories around gender, if they're socially constructed, they have to be enforced. That's what social construction means, is that you impose on human babies as they become children and then adults, you impose on them a set of expectations as how they ought to be in the world by virtue of their sex. And that will govern their interactions with other persons of the same and different sexes. And that's a set of expectations that are imposed on people, and therefore acts as constraints on how they live their lives. If that weren't the case, then it's not socially constructed. So I don't think you can have it both ways. If you can, if the emancipatory vision is that all persons should be able to flourish, equal access to the social material conditions to live a flourishing life, and that means that since we know there's a distribution within both biological men and biological women, there's a distribution within them of dispositions that we identify culturally as masculine and feminine, as opposed to all women having the same dispositions and all men having the same dispositions. We know it's not, the distributions overlap substantially, whatever these underlying dispositions might be. In my view, the social construction of gender always imposes constraints on people and prevents people from fully realizing the mix of dispositions that would be most flourishing for their particular way of being in the world, and that therefore a degendered world would be the emancipatory vision, not a de-sexed world. And there'd be many women who would adopt roles and practices in the world that we identify as feminine or within our current gender constructions, but there'd be many men as well. And the balance between what we currently consider masculine and feminine identities would no longer correspond in any rigid way to the biological distinction between men and women. There would be just a full spectrum of dispositional identities within each sex category, and therefore would no longer constitute socially constructed genders. Well, that's my view on that matter, question of what the emancipatory vision is. This is getting us away from the substance of the argument in the paper, which was why the difference between the Marxism and feminism in terms of their emancipatory visions bears on the different challenges they face in terms of their explanatory theories. And let me just briefly state what that problem is, and it's the following. I don't know any feminist who worries about the following question. If we had a world in which male domination was eliminated, where there was no longer vestiges of patriarchy, and biological men and women, boys and girls, all had equal access to all of the social and material conditions to live flourishing lives, and that their genders were irrelevant to their opportunities and capacities for flourishing. We lived in a world that was egalitarian in that sense. So either gender equality or gender dissolution. I don't know any feminist who then says, my God, would that world blow up in our faces? Would it disintegrate because of the contradictions of gender equality? That's a non-issue. It's taken for granted that there are huge obstacles to get there, but there's no particular inherent contradiction that would unravel being there. Whereas in a class context, there's a huge concern that a classless society would simply be unviable, that to organize complexity and interdependence in a complex division of labor without hierarchy and domination and exploitation, it just might not work. And that's why there's all these debates about how you would organize a socialist economy, whether you need planning and markets, all this stuff. These are big macro institutional problems, and that's because there's a macro coordination problem posed around class that is not present around gender. It doesn't mean that gender doesn't have macro problems, and we need to get out of here because there's a meeting here at 12. So nobody else is here yet, so we're not quite... two sentences and we'll be done. It's not that there aren't macro issues around gender. There are. We have to worry about the kind of laws and policies and state institutions that would facilitate gender equality. But there are no macro contradictions that have been identified as intrinsic to the gender equality project. One could imagine one. So here's an example of what would be a macro contradiction, which I don't think anybody gives credibility to. I don't. But it's a possible one, which is, let us suppose that relatively few people would want to have children and take on the responsibilities of childcare in the absence of highly gendered relations, because the identities that people would actually end up with in such an egalitarian world would not be the kinds of identities which support the sacrifice that people have to make. Not sacrifice in material terms, but in terms of cutting off other options for how they spend their time. The sacrifices people have to make if they're going to be serious about raising children. So that instead of having fertility rates that are roughly around 2 children per pair of men and women, you'd get fertility rates of around 1. Well, in the long term, a fertility rate of around 1 means demographic collapse. You know, it means that your population is cut in half every generation. And that's unsustainable. You can't cut your population in half every generation. So one argument for why you need male domination would be, if the only way you can maintain a fertility regime, at least at reproductive level, is through male domination, which I don't believe. I don't think it's a plausible account, but it could be. You know, we don't know what the unintended consequences. If the unintended consequences of the kind of individualism of individual flourishing and the narcissism that comes with that is, I don't want to have children, it takes up too much time. You know, if that becomes the dominant cultural form that would emerge out of that egalitarian context, well, if that were true, again, you have to keep saying, because it's going to be on podcast, somebody could take this out of context. If that were true, then you'd have the equivalent of the coordination failures and incentive failures in a classless society that renders class and hierarchy a necessity in order to have minimal efficiency economically. Well, this would be to have minimal efficiency demographically. But because nobody takes that seriously, I think the explanatory challenge for feminism becomes very different than it is for Marxism. Marxism has to have, as part of its explanatory challenge, understanding how macro systems work and are reproducible, whereas in feminism, the explanatory challenge is much more micro around the processes of, and mechanisms of gender and their micro transformations. Okay.